Okay, welcome back to the Greg Kelly podcast. And what the heck is going on? Look, I think this thing is winnable by the president. Yes, I do. The media, they have created this illusion that it's over. It's not. There are all kinds of possibilities for the president. The idea that Joe Biden is the president-elect is a fiction. It's a fabrication. He is not the president-elect. That is a technical designation that the media do not have the authority to confer. That does not happen until December, until the electors convene. And I think by that time, this will be a totally different picture. But what do I know? Let's bring in an expert, one of the top pollsters in the entire country, John McLaughlin. McLaughlin and Associates. He was the president's pollster, Donald Trump's pollster in the 2016 campaign. He helped him win, and I think he's going to help him win again. John McLaughlin was working with the president throughout 2020, and John, you were right all along in that this race was so much tighter than any other polls suggested, and certainly the media suggested. Anyway, how are you, John?
I'm doing well. I'm just waiting for the recounts and the audits, so like everybody else. So, but what an understatement. For weeks on your program, I was saying that it was going to be close, and close seems to be an understatement at this point. So, so you were giving your viewers an accurate picture, while right to the end, a lot of these media pollsters were, allowing their bias to interfere with their work, or maybe it was, they're biased in that they were trying to will an outcome where they kept putting out polls that said we were going to lose and we were going to lose badly. And they were talking about a blue wave and a Biden landslide. And here we are where you've got five states that represent 63 electoral votes, Arizona, Nevada, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, all separated by less than a percentage point that, anything less than a percentage point, you should get a recount and see what happens because you never know.
Well, it's amazing. You were saying this for months and months and months. And look, I don't know about the science of polls. I really don't. But you seemed extremely credible to me. And I'll tell you, a part of it was your demeanor. You seem very confident, and not only confident, you were cheerful about it. You're one of the few pollsters out there who's you're not afraid to smile. I mean, you're very pleasant, and I think you're very honest. There's an honesty and a straightforwardness about you that, quite frankly, a lot of these other pollsters don't have. And my theory is this. A lot of those pollsters are, do I want to say corrupt? No, but they're compromised. They're compromised. They are trying to convey an image or a picture that may or may not exist. Usually it doesn't, or sometimes it doesn't, for their paying client. Am I right?
Well, I can speak. I can speak for myself. It's like I tell people the truth of how I see it, and it's not an exact science. You're dealing with the science of statistics, so you got to be really careful. And plus, it's volatile. Elections are volatile now, where you get information almost instantaneously with social media and the internet, as well as the mainstream media and big tech. So things can change on a dime. I mean, I worked for the president 4 years ago, and I often tell them that we didn't make them pay for a landslide, but out of 139 million votes then, which was a record, we were able to win by literally 78,000 votes in three states, and 10,000 in Michigan, 22,000 in Wisconsin, and 46,000 in Pennsylvania. And now here we are, where we've got five states with 63 electoral votes that all less than a percentage point separates them. And they should all have recounts. I mean, Georgia, out of basically the over 5 million people that voted, they're separated by 10,000 votes.
Well, and we didn't have recounts. We didn't have recounts in 16. So tell us the difference, though, this time around. I mean, obviously, for me, it's the mail-in situation, which was thrown together and kind of cheaply done and rushed and probably wide open to mischief.
Right. And there could be fraud, absolutely, because there's lots of instances of fraud over the years in smaller elections where the stakes weren't as big. And in this election, you're looking over 150 million votes cast, of which two-thirds of them came in early. You had over 100 million people vote before Election Day. And whether it was early in person or it was absentee vote by mail, The governors ahead of time, the Democrat governors, particularly in the battleground states where they had Republican legislatures like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, the governors were trying to eliminate basic things like signature verification or voter identification. In North Carolina, a federal judge in February, an Obama appointee, had eliminated voter ID because they had passed that in a referendum. So there's 15 states that don't have voter identification laws where somebody shows up on election day or somebody sends in a mail-in ballot, you don't have to ask them for identification. So it's just, you're just enabling fraud at that point, and states are allowed to determine their own rules. So that, you know, you've seen this where plenty of times urban machines, they can manufacture a lot of votes pretty quickly, like Milwaukee did on election night, someplace between, I don't know, 4 and 5 a.m. All of a sudden, you know, we went from being ahead in Wisconsin by 100,000 votes to being behind by 20,000 votes. So again, you got 3.2 million votes there. You're separated by literally 0.6%, 20,000 votes. I mean, there should be a recount. There will be a recount in Wisconsin. And they've actually reversed. 2 years ago, they reversed a state Supreme Court justice race in their recount. So if there's something that unusual that happened, you know, they'll pick it up and we'll see what it is then. And until then, none of these results are certified. So you have to have the counts. You got to finish counting all the votes, all the legal votes. You have to play by the rules. There's provisional ballots in Pennsylvania for people that showed up at the wrong location on election day. And it seems to be they're overwhelmingly Trump voters, because what was a 150,000 plus margin for Joe Biden has been cut to 41,000 votes just by counting those ballots. So and you're talking about almost 7 million ballots counted. So so that's a lot of ballots to count and a recount. And you've got mail-in ballots that were, there's stories now that they were told to postmark it, to backdate it, so that it'd be legal ballots when they were mailed in late.
So look, right now the media are actively conveying the picture that this is over. President-elect Biden, you know, and they're calling him that. And I said last night, I've been tweeting this, and I know I'm right. But tell me, like, president-elect is not an official designation at this point. All right. I think you already admitted that, and we agree. So let me ask you this. This is all unprecedented. The election experts I see on TV are like, well, it's very difficult to overturn the results of an election, which I know is true. But this is not a typical election with that voter, with the mail-in stuff. And there's a lot more material to review. And it may be unprecedented, but in a way that's favorable to our side.
Right. And they owe it to the country to actually count the votes, count all the legal votes, assure everyone this was played, you know, it was played by the rules. Because if they don't, and they literally, you're saying, right, the media has basically coronated Biden as the president-elect, but these states haven't certified their counts. And then the ones that are going to have automatic recounts, like Wisconsin and Georgia, you got to wait for their votes to come in. And there's legal actions in Pennsylvania where ballots that were counted that came in after Election Day have been, according to Supreme Court Justice Alito, have been ordered to be set aside. So the governor there can't change the rules. The legislature gets to, pass the laws relevant to the election, and those laws need to be followed. So, you know, if they go through the whole process and Joe Biden's still ahead, then he's the president-elect. The states will certify him, and then he'll have the electoral votes. But if they don't go through the process, then there'll always be suspicion or people will think that something wasn't done right. They'll think that they rushed this for a reason. And so they owe it to the country to count all the votes, go through the process, and then certify who won which states and who got which electoral votes.
Now, right now, the media are also saying, and they're saying, well, there's no evidence of voter fraud. And there's no evidence of widespread voter fraud. I've been hearing that for a while. And now that's their mantra. One observation from me, here we have the media, broadcast media especially, very, very highly paid individuals sitting in New York and Washington, D.C., like sitting there and saying, well, we have not seen evidence of widespread voter fraud. Like, it needs to be presented to them that they are some sort of like authority, and you need to bring it to them. In the wake of 2000, Tallahassee, I mean, the whole media community flooded Tallahassee. Everybody went there. But the mindset now is you have to bring it to us. So that's my observation. But two, is this stuff discoverable by the media? Is it the kind of stuff that is systemic and you see it broadly? It's hard to find individual examples that you can actually, you know, email somebody.
Right off the bat, we should check the emails, but they're not looking for evidence. They're trying to, the media bias has really cost them their credibility because they're unwilling to look at things. There's already been stories in different publications about what I just mentioned, like postal employees were told to backdate the ballots. Look at Philadelphia. They were counting the ballots without Republican monitors in there. And that's from what I gather, according to state law in Pennsylvania, that's against the law. So if the mayor of Philadelphia refuses to allow Republicans in the room while they're counting, you know, qualified election monitors, just to make sure it's transparent and fair, the key thing is signature verification. I mean, do they have, I mean, as you're getting mail-in ballots, is it from a person? Have they signed their ballot? Has it been filled out according to state law? And they wouldn't let Republicans in the room. So if that's not evidence of you know, something is going amiss and there could be fraud, I don't know what else is. So if they say they don't see it, it means that they're not looking for it, and they're never going to look for it. It's just like Hunter Biden's hard drive. They got the goods on them in emails. You have a witness and a business partner, and Bob Alinsky, who came out and publicly testified to the fact that Hunter Biden was allocating money for Joe Biden. And there's emails to that effect that was coming from, you know, a Chinese state-owned business. So and we're not talking about little amounts of money. We're talking about millions of dollars. And still they wouldn't cover it. I mean, we're going to have a poll that we're going to put out tomorrow with 36% of the Biden voters weren't aware of this. And it's because the mainstream media didn't cover it, and they censored the New York Post when they wrote about it.
So wild. Look, you're a pollster. Do you have any duties at this point? I mean, is there anything for you to do? I would imagine this is outside your area, or are you going to work?
I'm not a lawyer, so it's like I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a I can look at the polls, and I can say I can do a polling analysis, but I think this is going to affect public opinion. So we, you know, America's a democracy. People have opinions. We'll continue to poll, and we'll get ready for the next round of elections. And there will be elections next year. There'll be a mayor's race in New York City. There'll be a governor's race in New Jersey, governor's race in Virginia with state legislators. And there'll be runoff elections in Georgia on January 5th, it looks like, because if President Trump doesn't win Georgia, it's not likely that Senator Perdue was able to avoid the runoff.
How suspicious are you? How suspicious are you? This has been noted that the Republicans in Congress running for re-election or running for election to Congress did very well. Democrats had a disastrous night on Tuesday. Yet the president, who is at 95% approval among Republicans, at first glance here, not as well as they did. How suspicious is that in and of itself?
Well, I think by and large, where the Republicans did well, it was on Donald Trump's coattails in areas that he won. So he was a foundation that the party stood on, and the fact that he got, you know, the fact that nationwide that he's at least at the current count, he's got 71 million votes, which is 8 million higher than we got last time, and Biden has got 75 million votes. I mean, for the Republicans to have kept as many Senate seats as they did, and it's not certain that they have a majority, and because they haven't called the race in North Carolina for Senator Tillis, they haven't called it for for President Trump, even though the president's been hovering around 70,000 to 80,000 votes and they stopped counting in North Carolina. I mean, they should have called North Carolina election night for the president, but they didn't do it because that would give them another 15 electoral votes, and it was hurting their narrative with Joe Biden. So they haven't called that Senate seat. But it's clear that since President Trump won North Carolina, Senator Tillis has won, and that's an important Republican seat. And you know, Senator Perdue Senator Loeffler appear to have greatly benefited from President Trump's vote totals in Georgia. But on the other hand, we'll see. I mean, right now, President Trump and Joe Biden are separated by only 10,000 votes. And we'll see in the recount, maybe
10,000 votes where? I'm sorry.
Statewide in Georgia.
In Georgia. Hey, yeah. Can I? I saw Florida get called at 8 o'clock at night for Newsmax called Florida for the president, and it looked like a pretty decisive win, which it was, and did very well among Latinos and blacks, and it's a very diverse state. So my theory is that call, that Florida looking as good and as early as it did for Trump, freaked out not only the Democrats but the media, and their plans went into high gear at that point. Am I crazy?
No, you're exactly. That really bothered them. They thought, according to their polling or according to the media polls out there, that even though Florida had been closing to, you know, we were supposedly down, but we always thought we were a little ahead in the state at the Trump campaign. But according to the media polls, it was supposed to be Biden winning. And, you know, the Democrats put a lot of money in there. Bloomberg put a lot of money in there. We're talking tens of millions of dollars again. They could have spent $1 billion in Florida for all I know. But the president won it decisively by well over 300,000 votes. And by, you know, what appears to be 3 percentage points. But Florida, I used to poll for Governor Jeb Bush when he was the governor, and I polled for the Republican Governors Association. In fact, I was in the room in the 2000 election presenting post-election poll numbers to Governor Bush and the other Republican governors when they got the word that the Florida Supreme Court had ruled against his brother with the ballots, etc. And I had done election day work on the exit polls for CBS Radio with an honest liberal, Jeff Garin, who's a Democrat pollster. And we didn't make the call. There was Chris Lahine from the Gore campaign was calling up and trying to lobby us to get us to call the state for Gore, because the 3 o'clock exits had Gore up 3 points. And we looked at both Jeff and I looked at the exit polls and said they only got 2% Cuban. It should be 5. They have 17% African-American. That was too high at the time. When you did the adjustments, it was a dead even race. Shouldn't have been called. Hey. For whatever reason, CBS called it. And Florida ever since has fixed their election laws.
They fixed their election laws and they had it all kind of squared away, and other states didn't. Hey, by the way, the specificity that you guys have, like, you know, 17% Cubans or whatever. I mean, like, that has always amazed me. I mean, like, how do you know? How do you get that data? I mean, how do you know that? Just
from polling. I mean,
but you got to extrapolate. I mean, you've got to, you talk to 15 Cubans and then you make determinations about, you know, a million. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean. And is there, it's not exact. I it can't be, right?
Well, in a state like Florida, there's a voter list of all the voters that are there, the 15 million voters that are there. And so you know who they are. You know who they registered by party. You know you can match that up with databases that all the parties have. So you know, like consumer databases will have 5,000 to 7,000 pieces of information about a person. So you know all this information going in. So you can model and build a good survey if you want.
Did you just say 5,000 to 7,000 pieces of information about one person?
Right, right. What your house is, where your income is, what your...
I don't think there's 7,000 things to know about me. I mean, how? Give me an example of how granular, if you will. That's a word you guys like to use. Like, what's a really obscure thing that some polling company or some database has about me?
Well, if you have a pet, but we would know you're a veteran, right? You're a Marine Corps pilot. You have a pilot's license. We would know those things. We would know you went to Fordham University. We would know those things. So, and if you subscribe to anything that if you're a practicing Catholic and you donate to charities, et cetera, We know those things, and they correlate those things with those attributes with other attributes, so they know if you're more likely to be a Republican, and they'll call it an affinity score. If you're a Republican or a Democrat or if you're independent, they'll measure those things. But when we get into an election like this, it's pretty easy to set up a good poll and then to execute the poll, come back and say, okay, you know, we can look at undecided voters and we can decide if, you know, where they're going to win. Plus the other part in Florida, you have a history of people, whether they vote by absentee mail, whether they vote by early in person, or whether they vote on election day. And it's a science down there. Florida, to their credit, Jeb Bush fixed the election laws so they would never have an embarrassment again. Ron DeSantis came in as governor, and he fired the incompetent people in Miami-Dade and Broward County that were messing up the elections there. And they've got a good system. So when they called it, I think a lot of Democrats were worried. And with the mail-in ballots, et cetera, that probably launched them into, well, where else can we win? And you saw a lot of the urban machines were cranking votes for days after the election because they knew they were in trouble. They knew that it was going to be a very close race with President Trump, that he might win. And until they certify these results, until you have the recounts and they certify the results and there's audits and the legislatures approve of those results, we can't be sure of who actually won this till we get to that point.
And who's in on that? Who knows that? Like, I see folks on television, the Sunday shows, you know, there's Rahm Emanuel and there's George Stephanopoulos, and he's indignant and saying there's no evidence of voter fraud. That's what Stephanopoulos said to Kristi Noem. And how much are they aware of the deception? Do they know it? Are they actively scratch that? Do they know what really went down?
Well, George, a lot of these people, like you mentioned George Stephanopoulos, he was a former Democrat operative. He was integral. He was at the highest levels of both of President Clinton's first and his second campaigns for president. So he knows plenty of operatives he could call and find out. And I'm sure he speaks regularly with friends of his who are Democrat operatives and pollsters and media people and data people. So he could find out easily. And
what about in the Democrat Party? What about just Democratic operatives, your colleagues on the Democratic side? Do they know?
They would. Somebody would know. And you could, by the way, with these days with emails, the thing about an email is the E stands for eternal. So all you have to do is FOIA the emails to see if there was anything going back and forth from, say, Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania or the mayor of Philadelphia or Biden campaign operatives. You could find those things out. And if there was some sort of manipulation or fraud going on, then you could find it out. But it would have to be investigated.
Well, these guys probably used encrypted WhatsApp or whatever. I mean, I bet they would have stayed off of email. Interesting, very interesting. All right,
yeah,
so
that's what they said about Hunter.
Yeah. Did you see him last night? By the way.
I know. That's like, holy cow.
Finally came out. Yeah.
But they have texts too. You know, you find. I mean, President Trump with the investigations, the phony investigations. There were plenty of texts among Biden administration FBI people that you could see that they knew they had nothing, and it's quite clear that they were fabricating a phony Russian interference. It was totally phony for the last 4 years, and they misled the American people, and the media was in on it.
Beautiful moment in the second and last debate where Joe Biden, regarding the laptop situation, which the moderator did not bring up, but the president did. He says, Joe says, 50 national security experts, including 5 former CIA directors, said this has all the hallmarks of a Russian disinformation campaign. And then Trump jumps in. You mean the laptop is Russia? And the look on Trump's face, you know, give me a break. And then you can see for a split second, Biden is revealed as a liar. He knows it. I think a lot of people in the business knew it, because that letter, by the way, that he was referring to, 50 national security experts, They actually never even saw the laptop. It was a purely political document to give him some sort of a cover, a veneer of cover. But that was, to me, smoking gun proof of deception, knowing deception on his part. A lie. And that really bothered me. So wait, what was my point about that? So the laptop is, all right. So there's text. There may be texts, and we may see them someday. So how optimistic are you right now? And I'll just note to anybody just joining us or hasn't heard my podcast before or seen my show on Newsmax, you know, I'm quite overt. My show is an opinion show. I am conservative. I am pro-Trump. I like what he's done for the country. And generally, believe it or not, even though I know it's fashionable to say you don't like the tweets, you don't like the name calling, I actually am very comfortable with the style. I find it refreshingly candid, and I think it's actually healthy for the country. So that's where I'm coming from, and I'm very above board about it. So look, how are you optimistic? What is your mood right now? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I don't know until they count the votes, but when they count the votes and they go through the recounts, I think President Trump will do better. Do I have any factual evidence other than that I said it was going to be a close race and then the poll said it was going to be close? I don't have anything current. I'm like everybody else. We're waiting to see what the counts and recounts have in the states, and then as far as the future goes, if President Trump gets reelected, I'll be very optimistic. If, on the other hand, Joe Biden wins this election, I'll be very pessimistic, because the kind of policies he was promising, $4 trillion tax increase, the idea of open borders, the idea of defunding the police, or he said shifting the police, et cetera. I mean, if he puts in policies that they had in the Democrat platform, it won't be good for the country. And I think most Americans know that, but it appears he got plenty of votes in plenty of states. But when we asked in the post-election survey that we did our own of 1,000 people after the election on November 2nd and 3rd, people that had already voted or voted on election day, when we asked them if they were better off now than they were 4 years ago, or worse off, 61% to 38%, they said they were better off. And for us to be with that kind of number in a 50-50 race, I have my suspicions that I think we may have done better than these counts are saying right now. And if that comes about, it'll be very interesting to see what the final poll, final voter count numbers are, final election numbers are in these key states. So what bothers me
right now, there's some chorus that says, well, for the good of the country, we need to wrap this up. And I'm all about the good of the country, but the country is just fine right now. There is nothing that says that we need a president-elect designated right now. This is not about continuity of government. All of that stuff is, like, nobody has to worry about that. The government is functioning. You don't have to have a designated person at this point. And it does raise suspicions, again, all over. A few months ago, maybe weeks ago, they were trying to get Trump to promise a peaceful transfer of power, win, lose, or draw. That was how the question was. And win, lose, or draw. So if you win, will you relinquish power? If you tie, will you relinquish power? Very, very strange. And I feel like the wheels were already in motion, right?
Yeah, it was obvious. I mean, that was they were trying to set up the whole point during the campaign, they kept manufacturing polls. Like CNN had polls that were down double digits, and they were putting out polls with only 25% Republicans. And we knew that was wrong nationally. And their exit poll that came out after the election, they said it was 35% Republican. So it was no wonder they could manufacture a poll saying we're down double digits, because they'd shorted Republicans 10 points, and they did it with a straight face. So they were trying to demoralize us and mislead us through the whole campaign. And they were misleading the American public, and to them, anything justifies their goals, and it's really wrong. And that's what's scary about, if Joe Biden actually wins and, you know, implements these policies, we'll be seeing more censorship from the big tech companies. We'll see. God knows what China will get away with. The middle America will get hurt. And if they raise taxes and kill jobs, if they phase out the oil industry, it's they're going to hurt the country. And that's what I'm pessimistic about. That's most concerning.
So when CNN would put out a poll showing Biden with double-digit lead, that is meant to discourage Trump voters. And tell us a little bit about how that works and how long suppression polls have been around.
Well, they clearly, what they do is as long as I've been polling, they've been around where I can tell you the Washington Post, when they put out the poll that we were down 17 points in Wisconsin right before the election, that was par for the Washington Post. And the president called me about it, and I said, you know, they do this all the time. And it, like, I worked in elections in Virginia where for governor, they would put out an editorial saying the Washington Post endorses the Democrat and runs down the Republican. And that would be the TV news that night and the next morning in Virginia. And they would be in the field at the same time they were making news against us. And then they would put out a poll that we always thought was skewed. They would say that the Democrat's going to win. And then, you know, George Allen became governor anyway. Jim Gilmore became governor anyway. But so, you know, the Washington Post had a history of doing this. And here they were doing it to President Trump in Wisconsin to say we were down 17 points. He calls me up from, he was out doing rallies in Las Vegas and Arizona. And I said, the poll's wrong. They have 8 points fewer Republicans. It's wrong. He said, why would they do this? I say, so if it's a cold, rainy day with long lines in Wisconsin, people are showing up, maybe your people would say, ah, he can't win. He's down 17 points. We won't bother to show up and vote. And he said, they would really do that? I said, yeah, the people that run their polls are smart people. There's no way that somebody with a PhD or a master's degree is putting out a poll like this, not knowing what they're doing. So, and the president, he recounted that at a rally, that conversation at a rally in North Carolina. But he did such a phenomenal job getting our vote out with all this. I mean, they just kept throwing bad news at us and bad polls at us. And they were making the case that Trump can't win. They were talking about the blue wave. They were talking about a Biden landslide, just like they talked about a Hillary lock 4 years ago. They doubled down on the same strategy. And when you look at the closeness of the vote in all these states, there was a historic high turnout, but they were trying to run it down. And maybe they did run it down somewhat, but, and they knew, worst part was from the polls they were taking, they knew that their vote for Biden was already banked. They knew that their votes had come in the mail or voted early in person. And if Election Day didn't happen, there would have been a Biden landslide. They knew the Trump voters were listening to the president saying, make sure your vote's counted. You got to go on Election Day or you got to go early in person. So we didn't start catching up until right before Election Day. And then we probably didn't get most of the states we won. We probably didn't have the votes until Election Day. So they knew we were vulnerable to that kind of suppression strategy to say, don't bother coming out, Biden's going to win. And it backfired because just like a good football coach, you know, when somebody says something, they hang it on the locker room door. President Trump was basically putting that on the locker room door, telling his people to get out there and vote and prove the media and their polls wrong.
So, back to Fort Dix and Vince Lombardi. well, yeah, it's funny. I quoted Vince Lombardi in a tweet. It's apocryphal, but I think he said, show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser. And, right. I don't know. I like that one. What did your dad, he went to Fordham. Played for Vince Lombardi.
And, Lombardi was the offensive coach when he was recruited. But then Lombardi went to Army that year. So he left and went to Army that year. But he knew him. He was – my dad played at Fordham Prep, and then he played at Fordham College until he got hurt, his shoulder got hurt. And then he finished up ROTC at Fordham and went into the Fighting 69th.
What was his job in the Army?
He was a lieutenant. Did his time. He was ROTC at Fordham, and then he did he was a lieutenant in the 69th.
So where'd you go to high school?
I went to Albertus Magnus High School in Rockland County, New York.
And were you good at math? And I always think pollsters are good at math, statistics, but what were your interests back then?
Well, back then, I was good at math. My dad was an actuary and, solid Catholic school education. And I'm actually the family failure because All my uncles played sports in college, mainly basketball. My brothers both played college basketball. I wasn't that good, so I was in the math league. So I went to Fordham on three different scholarships, all for academics, and all my brothers played college basketball.
No kidding. You had three academic scholarships for what?
By Regents, alumni, and then a scholarship from the school. So they paid for some. We still had to pay some, but I had three different scholarships there.
When you were in the math league, did they call you guys mathletes?
No.
That was a term that we had. Mathletes. It was a thing. It was like that. It was not pejorative, but they were called mathletes. No.
Uh-huh. No.
Okay. What'd you major in college?
Nerds might have been something.
What was your major?
I had a major in. I finished. I got an MBA out of Fordham, quantitative methods and finance. But undergraduate, I went and I had a combination of public administration, which was political science, business, and that was, you get a certificate at the time for that, so that was good.
So what was your first, and by the way, you have, you mentioned your brothers, one of them, Jim McLaughlin, is your colleague.
Business partner.
Yeah. You've worked together. He said the McLaughlin Associates is you, John, and your brother, Jim.
Right. So Jim is he's the younger, taller, better looking, nicer partner. He's very, very good and very popular. People like him. He had a great day. A lot of his clients appear to have won. They may still be counting, mail-in ballots, but different members of Congress, and Rob Astorino, who's in the New York area as well, and it appears to have won for state senate. So we had a pretty good day in terms of our clients being successful across the country, whether it was in Florida or whether it was in New York. Like Congressman Zeldin won re-election. It appears that Madison Cawthorn won election in North Carolina.
Oh, that's the guy who's interesting. He's a paraplegic, 25 years old, with the youngest member of Congress now and possibly ever. Very interesting guy. I like him. Let me just quick time out. When I look at Joe Biden, and I happen to have a picture of him right here from 1987, he is, and if you listen to him, and if you listen to him from back then, to me, an extremely average, mediocre, totally not worthy of the presidency politician. You've been in the business for a long time. What kind of reputation did Joe have in your circles?
I make no bones about it. I'm a partisan Republican. I'm more likely a conservative, more philosophically conservative pollster. So I never really got to meet him, know him personally. But on the other side, he was somebody that the Democrat Party could always count on. And he probably was an integral part of the transition of Delaware, where it used to be a reliably Republican state back when Reagan was president. You had Senator DuPont there, and you had Bill Roth there, and you had different Republicans that would regularly win the state. And in fact, when I helped Steve Forbes run for president in 96, we actually beat Bob Dole in that state. That was our first primary win.
You worked with Steve Forbes in 96.
Yes.
Oh, my God. No, I remember that so well. The flat tax. I thought he was hope, growth, and opportunity. That guy was amazing, and he still is.
Still is amazing. And then Steve is a great personal friend. And but people of Delaware at the time loved it. And since then, you've had, over these 20-plus years, the state has transitioned to a reliably Democratic state because it's become a suburb of Philadelphia, where a lot of Democrat voters have moved down from Philadelphia into the state near Wilmington, and you have also people from Washington moving over to their coast. So Joe Biden, he's been 47 years. He's been a member of the Democrat Party and has been reliably Democrat over those years. And so he's really somebody that the Democrat establishment could embrace and lift up, because they were afraid they were going to get Bernie Sanders. And, they thought that Bernie Sanders would lose to President Trump. And, we always thought we could beat Joe Biden, and you know, maybe when the recounts are done, we will have. But it was somebody that the Democrat Party, their establishment, could embrace. You know, and that's who he is. He's a member of the ruling elite, the Democrat establishment class in the country.
And you know, yesterday when it was 11:30, I had a cable news station. I was listening to it on my phone, actually. Anyway, they call it for Biden, and I start hearing horn honking and stuff like that. And I look out the window, and there's some celebration, nothing out of hand, but there's celebration and pots being clanged. And then I took my phone out and I recorded it. I took a video of what was happening, and I think I'm going to be looking at this video in a couple of weeks when the election is reversed or Donald Trump has a major breakthrough in his fight. And I hope I'm wrong, but I think there's going to be rioting. I think the same people, Trump supporters, who are discouraged and possibly sad right now, I hope they're not, because I think they're being fooled. But, you know, this is not a great time. They will, when they receive their bad news, which I do believe is coming, they're going to riot. The other side is going to riot. Not all of them, but a big enough portion for it to be dangerous for a lot of people out there. How do you feel about that?
Well, hopefully, if it's transparent and honest, the media will report it that way. And, you know, if for now, if any of these recounts come, put those states that are in question back into our column, electoral vote-wise, it'll be factual. The results will be there. And the media should be responsible and say, you know, should report it as accurate that these are the final results and that President Trump has won the electors in this state. And, you know, every vote matters and the election should go to him. If the media is irresponsible, then we're going to have problems. And they've been irresponsible. Not yourself, but the liberal media in this country at times has been very irresponsible and has made things worse. So we'll see.
So when you're back at, you get out of Fordham, Masters in Public Administration, what was your first job?
I worked in a bank, Nanuet National Bank, which is a subsidiary of Irving Bank. It was up in Rockland County.
What was your plan? I mean, did you want to be a banker or what was the deal?
I was going to go into finance. I worked at the bank. Then I went into municipal finance. I was the finance director of town of Clarkstown. And then a person that I'd known for a few years, Arthur Finkelstein, who was one of Reagan's pollsters, knew me from volunteering for Reagan's campaign, Jim Buckley's campaign. Other Ben Gilman was one of his clients. The congressman, the great congressman from Rockland County, was his client. He knew me that I used to work different campaigns as a hobby when you were a volunteer. And he offered me a chance to make my hobby my living, and I took it in 1982. Went to work for his firm for 9 years before I went out on my own. So,
By the way, Arthur Finkelstein, I believe he is the father of Andy Stein, correct?
No.
Are you sure?
No, he positive. He passed away. That's a different Arthur Finkelstein. But the one
there's another Arthur Finkelstein who's the father of Andy Stein, right?
I think so. I know Andy Stein, and he was a great friend and supporter of President Trump, and but that's not the same one. So the Arthur Finkelstein I knew was Al D'Amato's pollster. He was Connie Mack's pollster. He was very well known and he passed away a couple of years ago, but he was very well known in American political circles to insiders. But he wasn't somebody who would go on TV regularly, or he would try to avoid the press.
I've heard the name a million times. I just I was misinformed that he was related to Andy Stein, and I will have to. That's going to stay with me forever because I've always assumed that I'm not. That's not erasable. So, all right, now you go out on your own, and let's just jump ahead. When did you first meet Donald Trump?
First time I met him was 1986. I was going to a fundraiser for Al D'Amato for the senator's reelection, and it was at the Grand Hyatt, which at the time Donald Trump had developed and run, and he was going to the same fundraiser, and people I was with introduced me to him. He happened to be going there with Don King and Al Sharpton, and nobody really knew Al Sharpton back then, but I guess President Trump was then into his casinos, and they would have different, I guess he was a boxing enthusiast, and they would have those things. So I met him just casually then, but that was the first time I met him. After that, where I got to know him as far as working, April 2011, he wanted to run in 2012 for president. And a lot of people didn't take him seriously, but Dick Morris, the political consultant, introduced me to him because I'd known Dick from different races in North Carolina for Senate that we'd done worked on together. So he asked that I help President Trump prepare a plan to run for president for 2012. Spent a month writing the plan, and it was a serious plan, and we were going. He had to make a decision. Probably it was May of 2011. He was making a decision if he was going to run or not. And at the time, he had the highest rated reality TV show in the country with Celebrity Apprentice. And he was going to have to make a decision whether he wanted to run for president or keep the show. And because I told him, I said, I went through this with Steve Forbes when he ran for president. I went through this with Fred Thompson when he ran for president. Went through this with Arnold Schwarzenegger when he ran for governor. The minute you say you're running for office, they're going to take you off the air because of the fairness issue. So at the time, he called me and he said he just wasn't ready to run then. And it was good timing. I mean, he had a gut instinct that, we were all prepared to set up a campaign where we had people ready to join, and they were going to, in effect, work out of one of his buildings, have a headquarters there in New York. And in effect, it became the plan for 2016 that he implemented in 2015.
Did he consider running for governor of New York State? I heard that was reported at one point that was in the mix. Are you aware of that?
Yes. Yes. And he seriously considered it. Yep.
Good move that he didn't. That would have been kind of a quagmire, I think, right?
Exactly. And again, his instinct is very good, because in 2015, he decided he was going to run for president. And, Corey Lewandowski, somebody I'd introduced to whom he became the manager, he called me in January 2015. He says, he's really going to run this time. He signed a contract with me. I'm going to be the manager. Do you want to do some polls? They wanted me to do some polling then. And I said, at the time, I was going over to Israel the next day to work on Prime Minister Netanyahu's reelection. There was a March 17th election that year, and this was January. I said to Corey, I said, I'd love to, but I can't do it right now because you can't do Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu at the same time. they're just too demanding. So I said when I get back, we'll talk about it, but I got to get Bibi elected first.
You know, it's amazing though that you guys can go to another country. I mean, and do polling there. I just find that so wild. It's impressive that you can. I mean, the idea, and you go to these pretty exotic countries. Remember, James Carville was handling some election in like Kazakhstan. I mean, like, what in the hell? How do you get a grasp on all of it? Or is it just a numbers game?
Well, actually, people are people, and humans are we all want good things for our family. We have a lot more in common than different. There may be different languages and different culture. In Israel, there's a lot of people that are, you'll always run into people from New York over there. When you take polls and you listen to public opinion in a specific country, and I tend to only work for right of center candidates so that I'm not in any ideological conflicts, et cetera. But people, if it's a free and open democratic society, you can take a poll and they will tell you what they think, and you can help your candidate with their strategy, and hopefully they win. And that's the case. We were very fortunate that Prime Minister Netanyahu won that race, because that was one similar to Trump's races where they kept on putting out polls saying we're going to lose.
I got a quick observation and maybe a message. So Lynn Wood is the very prominent attorney based in Atlanta, I believe, who has now joined the Trump team in trying to uncover voter fraud and taking whatever necessary legal steps. My observation is this, and Lynn is all over social media. I mean, retweet this, follow me here. I think that, I don't know if that's where his efforts should be focused. Have you ever seen it? And that's one thing about the McLaughlins. You guys kind of keep a low profile in your own way. I mean, you pop up on TV, but You have, you're kind of like the best kept secret in polling for a while. Do you know what I mean? Well, first off, you may want to convey that to the team, because I just can't imagine this is a productive use of his time. Hopefully somebody else is doing it, but, you know, tweeting memes and stuff like that. I mean, we're already covered. And Lynn Wood, who's the attorney, is doing that. I don't know if that's so. Look, you don't have to comment, but I'm just curious. I don't know. So the other thing is, you guys have kind of kept, I think you really focused on your business and achieving and maintaining and growing your expertise, and now you're kind of making some public appearances. Am I wrong in my observation, or what's going on there?
No, you're right, because the campaigns are really about the candidates. If you want to run for office, you know, file and run as a candidate. But it's my job to help the candidates win, and to do that, you're most often making sure you're taking a good poll, you're giving a good analysis, and you're giving them advice. The vast majority of polls we take in politics, we don't publish, because that's important strategic information that the candidate has. And then, you know, half our business is corporate, has nothing to do with politics. And as long as, you know, and the corporate clients, if they do a market research study with us and their market share goes up 1%, they're ecstatic. Because that would mean a lot of money or revenue for the company. But when it comes to politics, you know, most often you got to get 51%. It's a much tougher game, and it doesn't pay as well, but you do it because you like it. So we, you know, most often those political polls are never published. We function best when we're out of the media, except, you know, if they do have to put out a poll, or in the Trump campaign, we were constantly battling bad media polls. And that's why I got a little more notice, because we had to push back on a lot of them that they were really doing it. There was malpractice going on there, and they were doing it because they had a bias and they wanted to see us lose.
As a pollster, do you spend much time with the candidate? Does it really even matter? I would imagine, Mike, that sure, you could shake hands at the beginning, but then it becomes just a kind of a scientific data problem that you've got to work out, and you could email them the results or whatever. So do you work with the candidate? Do you present the data personally, or is that all unnecessary?
Usually we do. And every candidate's different, but usually we do with their campaign team. Sometimes you work through the manager or the other consultants, media consultants, but sooner or later you got to meet the candidate. What was different about it this year was because of the coronavirus. So a lot of people, once that virus hit, you know, you were doing a lot of things by Zoom or by conference calls, and you weren't traveling as much. But in a normal year where you didn't have a global pandemic, you would be meeting and seeing the candidates. So President Trump, they would often have meetings where you'd go and you would discuss the polls. And he's different than most candidates because his background is business, not politics. But he could call you out of the blue, and you better have the answers, and you better know what you're talking about. And because he's the type of person who learns by asking questions, and not just asking, but also pushing back at you, making him believe what you're telling him is true. So he's extremely smart. And when you think about it, he built a multi-billion-dollar business on public opinion. Basically, he's his own brand expert. And you know, so you, when you discuss a poll with him, you better have your facts together, because he's most likely not going to believe it unless you tell him. and then if you give him good advice as a strategy, he'll follow it and he will make it his own.
You know, I've been in his presence a few times, and once over the summer, and he started asking me questions, a barrage of questions. And at one point I realized that he was testing me. It was mm-hmm. like, and then it went on from there. He had this intense focus, and I think he truly was quizzing me, not so much to get the data, just to see if I knew that what first the test was, does this guy know what he's talking about? And then, is he worthy of listening to? Have you ever mm-hmm. seen that approach? Was that what was happening when I was getting like kind of interrogated? Then he relaxed, and then it was a bit more No, I shouldn't say that. It wasn't a bet more, really. He was just kind of, I just felt that he was really, and beyond just asking me questions, he was like sizing me up. I heard my friend Mark Simone, who show you go on sometimes, says, you know, he's not only listening to you, he's got radar, he's got sonar, he's like, he's got all these other receptors that are working at the same time. And he's like kind of assessing your energy and all this other stuff. Does that make sense?
Yes. And it's almost like, you know, you went to Ford too. It's like the Jesuits were very good teachers and very good professors. They were, you really had to prove something to them. A lot of times, whether it was a course, you know, they would push back on you and they would tell you, you know, this wasn't good enough or that wasn't good enough. And he's kind of like that, where that approach where if you're going to get me to believe something, you're really going to have to push. And if you know what you're talking about and you push back, and you're right in what you're, you know, telling him, and it's not just because he doesn't suffer fools gladly. So if you don't know what you're talking about, you're not going to last. So.
You know, it's interesting about the Jesuit observation and that they do that, and they do that. There's a line in his book, Art of the Deal. He mentions Fordham very briefly. He said he got along well with the Jesuits, but I decided if I needed to go to college, I should test myself against the best. He was referring to the other students, I believe. So he transferred out of Fordham after 2 years, which is something that I thought about doing and was on track to do before I started finding my own path in sophomore year, which included not attending much class. But that's another story. Yeah, like that might be part of the legacy of Fordham, that kind of aggressive interrogation, which I did see some of at Fordham by these Jesuits. And that's interesting. You never know. So is the number one, what do you like to do when you're not handling all this stuff, data? You know, you have a hobby that has nothing to do with politics or numbers.
Just spend time with my family and, you know,
how big is your family?
My wife, Mary and I, we have 5 grown kids with 6 granddaughters.
You've got so, 5 grown kids.
Yes.
Ages what to what?
They're 38 to 26.
Damn.
So, yeah, right. I tell you, I went to Fordham in the 20th century, way ahead of you.
So. Do you lose? I always wonder. I mean, now, like when people, when you tell people that you came from, you have 5 kids, are they shocked like I am just then? I mean, it was very common at one point, but not really anymore. What is the reaction? Should I stop reacting that way when people tell me they have more than 3 kids?
People aren't that surprised. They're, sometimes they'll say, "Oh, you're Catholic." I'm like, "Oh yeah, sure." Yeah. So, but they, you know, it's something nice. I think, you know, what's different is people got married younger in the 20th century. Now in the 21st century, they wait a little bit. So, it's different. So,
yeah,
but it was good. It's like your dad went to Manhattan, right?
He went to Manhattan College, right?
Yep. Because I saw him recently. You know, he was at a fundraiser for Mike Lola, who won for state assembly up in Rockland County. So
he actually did a robocall for Rob Astorino. I don't know if you know that. And then,
yeah, well, very important because of the cashless bail issue in New York. I mean, the idea that there's this crime wave that's going on in New York State because of they're letting, you know, serious criminals out without bail. And they need to, and the commissioner, your dad, bravely stood up and, you know, supported the right candidates who are going to make changes on that law.
Yeah, that's crazy. And you can see the, so look, you've been very generous with your time. I just have a couple of very quick questions. When you do polling, do you do it via the phone? Do you do it via questionnaire? How do you actually do it? I know there are probably a million different ways, very complicated response, but generally, how do you do it?
With the change in technology, it's if you're going to do it by phone, it's a mix of landline and cell, where you're doing more on cells than you are on landline. But landline's eventually going to disappear. And then we can also do it with a mix of online or even text. And if they're, you know, if corporate surveys, a lot of them we're doing online, and we're doing focus groups online, and so technology is a tool to just get public opinion, and you could do it right whatever format or mode, but it's, but chances are it's headed to more of an online text and cell phone.
But you still call people on cell phones.
Yes. Now, for an election, the best way is to call them on a mix of cell phones and landlines.
Are you
mainly cell phones?
Are you clever with the return number? I noticed lately, I look at my phone and it's a number very similar to my number, off by like two digits. You know, same area code, same prefix, just and you're like, oh, that number looks familiar. I guess I should answer it. I probably know this person. By the way. You got to get a unique type of person though, who answers the phone. I mean, I don't answer the phone every now and then I'll still try, but you know, I think I might know somebody in Spokane, Washington. I should get this. Could it be that person? No, it's not. I mean, and I invariably hang up, or there are other tricks I use, with telemarketers, but anyway, I mean, nobody wants to take those calls. So is the type of person who does take that call, does that make the data suspect?
You have to be more careful in the way you do it. And cell phones, you probably want a shorter questionnaire. But the other part is, we're not a telemarketer. So right up front, you tell them, you're calling about public opinion issues or something, where we're not selling them anything. And people rarely get called by pollsters. So when you think about it, I mean, there's a, you know, the idea that you would be like, nationally, you do 1,000 interviews is a big sample nationally. So if you're doing calls in a state, it's maybe, but the difference is you got to do like 12 to 20 contacts to be able to get somebody to go through the survey with you. And you have to be careful the way you do it and who you're calling. We know who we're calling ahead of time, that they're a registered voter. We're screening them that they're likely voters. We're making them feel comfortable that they're willing to give their opinions. And it's rare that they get polled. So people a lot of times are more than happy to give you their opinions. And if you're not the media, they're probably pretty even happier. But then you have to be able to read it so that you understand that there may be people who aren't telling you everything. So in the analysis, you can predict how the outcome is going to come. But it is getting harder to take the polls, and you just have to take more time. And unfortunately for candidates, it makes it more expensive, so that a good poll becomes, it's necessary because they spend a lot of money on campaigns, yeah. but it costs them more money.
Last thing, it looks to me like a good chunk of the Republican Party establishment wouldn't mind one bit if Donald Trump leaves the stage. They have had it with him. They never liked him. Defending him is a full-time job. They don't want to be asked about him. He steals the limelight. There are a million reasons why they don't like him, and they want him gone. And I'm sensing that just in terms of how many surrogates he doesn't have, how thin his team seems to be. And that worries me. Again, I'm a big Trump supporter. I want him to be reelected, and I believe in him. But I don't think there are a lot of Republicans out there who don't or just fundamentally resent him, and they would be totally fine with Joe Biden.
No, that's the establishment. And when President Trump won the first time, I told him that we had a conversation. I told him that he's the only person in history that ever beat the Republican establishment and then went on to beat the Washington establishment. And they've resented that ever since. The rank and file of the Republican Party loves him. I mean, I have the survey, the post-election survey that we did. The president has a 53% national job approval, that they approve the job he's doing. And 95% of the Republicans approve the job he's doing. So the rank and file Republicans at the grassroots in the heartland of America love this president. But the ones in Washington that survive off of power and basically have not done well for the American people, that you know, until Donald Trump became the nominee, they were losing. And but the D.C. establishment, there's a problem with them. And if, you know, win or lose, this is in the final counts of for presidents, there are going to be primaries coming up in this year and next year. And if they want to run as members of the Washington establishment, the Republicans will lose. And if they want to try to perpetuate the policies of Donald Trump, and if he's reelected, try to continue his policies, they'll be rewarded. And it's just that simple.
I'm seeing something from Kaya Jones, who I've never heard of, but she's got a following on Twitter that's pretty significant, K-A-Y-A Jones, and she says this: Satan thought he won on Friday. Jesus walked out of the tomb on Sunday. Monday, it's on. Well, I like that. I like that. I think she's onto something. But we will see. John McLaughlin, really great talking to you. Thank you very, very much. And I really appreciate it, John. And, you know, we never get enough time to talk during those segments. It's always they play that damn music just when we're warming up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, we'll get together sometime. It's like I'll see you when they dedicate the basketball gym, the court at Rose Hill, to my uncle. Uncle Frank invites you to when they have the family Frank McLaughlin family court dedication. So,
oh, fabulous! When might that be, roughly?
They don't know yet because with the virus, what the basketball schedule is going to be hasn't been announced yet. So, so we shall see. But I will be more than happy to go back to Rose Hill with you, and then. But in the meantime, you do a great job. Your show has been a great job for your listeners. Your success is. You know, coming, you can see it growing with the ratings, and keep up the great work, because the great part about what you're doing is you're providing truth and fairness and honesty to the American people. So that's great.
Well, that was John McLaughlin again. He was right. He's been right for a very long time. He figured out how to get the right data to Donald Trump back in 2016. And for months this year in 2020, he said this would be a very close race when all those polls came in showing it would be a blowout. He was saying that's not the case. These are suppression polls. And you heard him, by the way. Very, very nice guy. Frank Luntz apparently apologized to him and gave him credit for being as right as he has been. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Listen, if you have an opportunity, rate this podcast, please. I know how to do it through iTunes or whatever, but there are ways through Spotify, and give it a review, positive or negative, just authentic. And anyway, I am available every night, weeknights, 7 o'clock on Newsmax TV. And I'm getting very prolific and aggressive on Twitter at Greg Kelly USA. And thank you very, very much. It's going to be a wild week, wild month. A lot of crazy stuff is in store. I do not think this is over. I think there is a real chance that Donald Trump will remain in office. But we shall see. All right. Take care.